West Universe Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis says Syria is taking seriously the U.S. warning against launching another chemical weapons attack. Mattis said there's been no attack since the White House issued a Monday night statement warning the regime of President Bashar al-Assad would pay a heavy price launching such a strike. White House spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked Wednesday if President Donald Trump is prepared to act preemptively.
I know that was the action decided. I'm not, of course, going to go into detailed conversations that may have taken place.
The U.S. said it saw active preparations for another chemical weapons strike at the Sheyrat airfield, the same base used for a similar attack April 4. Syria denies using chemical weapons. Nearly 90 were killed in that attack, prompting a U.S. cruise missile strike. That decision was defended Wednesday by U.S. UN Ambassador Nikki Haley in testimony before U.S. lawmakers.
We forced the Security Council to hold an open emergency session, which some member states didn't want. We drew a red line. If the UN would not act collectively, the United States would act alone. And we did.
Haley said she believed President Donald Trump saved Syrian lives by his actions. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov Wednesday said he hoped the U.S. would not use its intelligence assessment about Syria's intentions as a pretext for mounting a provocation. Zimbabwean activist pastor Evan Mawarire has been freed on bail 2 days after being arrested at a student rally and charged with promoting violence. The head of last year's large social media movement, hashtag This Flag Against Corruption, Injustice and Poverty, faces a September trial on separate charges of plotting to overthrow the government and insulting the national flag. This is VOA News. South Korean President Moon Jae-in is in Washington for talks with U.S. officials, including a dinner Thursday and discussions Friday with President Trump. Speaking to business professionals late Wednesday, Mr. Moon said his government wants a fair market order to increase both predictability and confidence. He also said he's committed to putting people and households at the center of his economic policy. The South Korean leader also held out the promise of greater economic opportunity if security challenges with North Korea can be overcome. Bruce Klingner served as the deputy division chief of the Central Intelligence Agency in Korea.
South Korea is a critical ally in Northeast Asia, and they've been hampered in developing a relationship with President Trump because of the impeachment of the previous president, Park Geun-hye. So Trump has already established a very good personal relationship with the Japanese prime minister, and also it seems a good relationship with the Chinese president. So the South Korean president is trying to establish that same relationship, trying to assert the importance of South Korea to the U.S. as well as in Northeast Asia.
At the U.N. Security Council Wednesday, the North Korean ambassador made a rare statement warning his country will continue to pursue a nuclear arsenal regardless of international sanctions, pressure, or military threat. Venezuela's embattled socialist president Nicolas Maduro has vowed to defend against what he called a coup attempt after a renegade policeman used a helicopter to strafe and drop hand grenades on the Supreme Court and Interior Ministry buildings Tuesday. An arrest warrant has been issued for the police pilot Oscar Perez. The U.S. is boosting security measures on all foreign airlines flying to U.S. airports, but is not as yet expanding a ban on laptop carry-on computers. Homeland Security Secretary Jack Kelly said the new measures will be phased in over months.
The threat is not diminished. In fact, I am concerned that we are seeing renewed interest on the part of terrorist groups to go after the aviation sector, from bombing aircraft to attacking airports on the ground, as we saw in Brussels and Istanbul.
Passengers can be expecting more overall screening, closer exam of personal electronic devices, more security around planes and terminals, and dogs trained to sniff out explosives. Australia's Catholic Church said Cardinal George Pell, Vatican treasurer, has denied multiple sexual assault offenses brought against police. The Archdiocese of Sydney said the cardinal will return to Australia to clear his name. Shane Patton is the deputy police commissioner for Victoria State.
Cardinal Pell is facing multiple charges in respect to historic sexual offenses, and there are multiple complainants relating to those charges.
Police have charged Pell in a legal action that requires his appearance in court July 18. He's the highest-ranking church official to be ensnared in the church's long-running abuse scandal. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bote in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 29th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenya's two main political coalitions have launched their campaign platform for the August elections.
They have focused on the same issues. Even the targets and the things that they hope to achieve are basically the same. The only thing you can say that is a bit different is the spirit in the two manifestos.
That's political commentator Sam Kamau. Liberia's Elections Commission says it has registered 26 political parties for the country's October elections. A Zimbabwe pastor and human rights activist is freed on bail. And the governor of Nigeria's Kaduna State reassures Igbos of his support and protection after they were given a three-month ultimatum to leave northern Nigeria.
The meeting was fruitful. The governor reiterated to them that we are better off in one Nigeria where our collective interests and collective destiny will be realized, far from those that are trying to incite people and to peddle hate speech.
Samuel Aruwan is spokesman for Governor Nasser El-Rufai of Nigeria's Kaduna State. Angola's parliament has passed a bill granting longtime President José Eduardo dos Santos a pension, but without the controversial clause giving absolute immunity from prosecution. And the president of the African Development Bank wins the 2017 World Food Prize Award. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Kenya's ruling Jubilee Coalition and main opposition coalition have both launched their campaign platforms for the August elections. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Launching their campaign pledges, the ruling Jubilee Party and opposition coalition National Super Alliance have promised to transform the country and Kenyans' lives. Both sides pledge to improve education, health, infrastructure, to foster economic growth, and to create jobs for millions of Kenyan youth. They also promise to fight corruption. The Jubilee Party, led by President Uhuru Kenyatta, is expected to win a second term in office. The party is campaigning on a platform featuring development projects like a passenger and cargo railway to win voters in the August polls. Political commentator Sam Kamau says the promises made by the government and the opposition are the same.
They have focused on the same issues. And generally, even the targets and the things that they hope to achieve are basically the same. The only thing you can say that is a bit different is the spirit in the two manifestos, partly because on the Jubilee side, they have been in government for the last 4.5 years. And this manifesto should be an audit of some of the things they have done and therefore what they can hope to achieve if they continue in government. For the opposition, is an opportunity for them to showcase what they can do if they are given the reins of power.
Some Kenyans are questioning whether the pledges made by the politicians can be achieved or implemented. Professor Herman Manyora is a political analyst and lecturer at the University of Nairobi. He says Kenyans are used to false promises.
These are things they can't do, they just promise. So to that extent, therefore, people are not putting much capital on this. People are not even expecting anything out of them. And more importantly, our people vote along tribal lines.
The opposition is promising to form an inclusive government, solve historical injustices, and unite communities. Manyora says an equal society can help bring an end to bad governance.
All these big things you say you want to do, you will not do them if you don't have a united country. If you don't have inclusivity, people feel they belong to this country. You cannot complete the road projects if you don't deal with corruption. Because then corruption will eat all the money.
Kenya has witnessed electoral violence in several campaigns over the years. In the 2007 disputed presidential election, up to 1,500 people may have died, and more than 250,000 were uprooted from their homes. In the August 8th election, Kenyatta is running for a second term in office against several challengers, including former Prime Minister Raila Odinga. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The chair of Liberia's National Elections Commission, Councillor Jerome Kokoya, says his commission is working hard to deliver a transparent, free and fair elections in October this year. Nomination of candidates is currently underway. Kokoya says his commission has registered 26 political parties so far for the election, including the Union of Liberian Democrats Party. A civil court judge ruled on Tuesday this week that the nomination of the party's standard bearer and the only female presidential candidate, Magdela Cooper, was null and void because her election did not follow the party's rules. Kokoya says his commission will enforce the court's ruling once any appeal process has been completed.
It's one of those that is registered with the National Election Commission. They have been around for a little while now.
There was a court ruling, as I was saying, on Tuesday, saying that the person who is the presidential candidate for this party, Ms. Magdela Cooper, according to the court ruling, her nomination is null and void. In that case, who does the Election Commission recognize?
Well, as you know, the court is the authority on deciding what the law is in our country, and that our country is one of law. Once the court has spoken, the National Election Commission have no choice but to follow what the court decision is. If the court says that the standard bearer of that party was elected in manner inconsistent with the procedure and therefore that election is nullified, we have to follow that. With respect to who we recognize, that would depend on the final determination. As you will know, we understand, though we don't have a copy of the ruling, so we can't speak much to that. But assuming such a decision was made, the court, I'm sure, will be communicating with us in our regard. But what we heard is that there was an appeal announced. If that is true, that an appeal was announced and granted by the court, then that means the appeal will serve as supersede. So that means the court decision may not be enforced until the appeal is heard. So what we would be doing is, assuming that information is correct, we'll be waiting for the final determination of the matter at the appeal level. Then at such time, I believe they could appropriately inform us as to the next step.
Mr. Chairman, how is your commission doing in terms of finances in preparing for this election?
Well, finances have been a challenge, but the government has lived up to what it promised to provide. As I said earlier, there was a budget of $45 million. Government committed to providing $20 million of that for the fiscal years of 2016 and 2017, which I guess will soon be ending. So the other $20 million, government in this current budget that has been debated, I think has made a commitment of another, $17 million. As far as I know, we look up to the government for that. But judging from the past experience, we are hopeful that the government will make that available.
Jerome Kokoya is chairman of Liberia's Elections Commission. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 29th. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 13 minutes past the hour. The governor of Nigeria's Kaduna State, Nasir Ahmed al-Rufai, has reassured the Igbo community of his support and protection. This came after Abdulaziz Suleiman, a spokesman for the Northern Youth Groups, recently gave Igbos 3 months to leave all northern parts of the country where they reside, own, and operate businesses. Suleiman also called on northern Nigerians living in other parts of the country to return to their respective homes. Governor el-Rufai condemned the ultimatum and directed his attorney general to charge the leaders of the youth groups with incitement. Samuel Aruwan, spokesman for Governor Rufai, tells viewers Peter Clotty that the governor is working with other northern governors to ensure the protection of Igbo community.
The leadership of Igbo community in the 19 northern states and Abuja actually met to review the situation. And at the end of the day, they equally met with the governor, where they thanked the governor for steering a leadership and a courageous move following the so-called ultimatum that was given to them by a group that claimed to have given them the ultimatum on behalf of the people of northern Nigeria to leave the north on or before 1st October 2017. So the meeting was fruitful. The governor reiterated to them
that we are better off in one Nigeria where our collective interests and collective destiny will be realized, far from going our different ways, far from those that are trying to incite people and to peddle hate speech.
What was the reaction of the Igbo community, particularly the leaders who met with the governor, and did the governor give them any assurances of protection, particularly in Kaduna?
Of course, they are coming to Kaduna was to meet and review the situation. Secondly, they came to meet with the governor to thank him for a courageous move, considering the steps that the Kaduna state government took immediately the so-called ultimatum was issued. Now, the governor went further to explain to them that the state government, in collaboration with security agencies, have equally taken adequate measures of protecting their life and property, their business interests, and any other thing that is there. And this is not only extended to the Igbo community, but to other peaceful Nigerians who are residing here in Kaduna, carrying out their legitimate businesses and other interests of theirs. And we also encourage them to know that government is deeply involved in confidence building, meaning peace building, consultation, liaison with community leaders. And we made it clear to them that if they have any fear, if they have any complaint, if they observe anything that is strange, that could be inimical to them, the doors of Kaduna State Government are wide open for them.
What is the coordination between the Kaduna governor and other states in terms of cooperation to protect not only the Igbo community, but non-ethnic Northerners who reside peacefully and go about their businesses?
There is a good working relationship between governors of the 19 northern states. We have a common heritage. We have common goods to protect together. We have so many things that we share amongst ourselves. And you may recall that the chairman of the Northern Governors Forum, the governor of Borno State, Alhaji Kashim Shetima, has equally condemned the said ultimatum and pledged on behalf of the Northern Governors Forum that the Northern Governors are working assiduously to protect life and property of not only the Igbo community, but all non-Northerners that are residing in Northern Nigeria.
What is next concerning this ultimatum that the governor has condemned, has assured to protect their life and property? What's next in the measures to ensure these promises are carried out to the latter?
Confidence building, consultation is going on. Peace building process is on. Talking to people, like I earlier explained, is also going on. And ensuring that people are adequately protected, these are some of the things that we are doing. And for obvious security reasons, we may not unravel the strategies that we are putting on ground to nip in the bud any attempt to bring about breakdown of law and order.
Samuel Aruwan is the spokesman for Nasser El-Rufai, the governor of Nigeria's Kaduna state. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from Kaduna. A court in Zimbabwe on Wednesday granted bail to a clergyman opposed to President Robert Mugabe's government and who is facing charges of inciting public violence along with protesting university students. Sebastian Mofu reports from Harare.
Police arrested Pastor Ivan Mawarire after he addressed University of Zimbabwe students protesting rising school fees on Monday. Since then, he and his driver, who was also arrested, had been in police custody. On Wednesday, the court granted him $200 bail. After the court ruling, Harrison Nkomo from Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights, who is representing Mawarire, said his client had done nothing wrong.
The papers are a bit confusing in terms of the manner in which they were treated by the police, but what actually transpired is that the University of Zimbabwe medical students were registering their displeasure in the hike of the school fees by the responsible authorities. And when violence broke, I think one of the students decided that there was need for divine intervention and called Ivan for a prayer. So it was after he went there to give a prayer that on his way out he was detained by the police.
That matches with what the clergyman posted on his Twitter account from his police cell that he had, quote, essentially been arrested for praying, unquote. He returns to court July 19 for his trial date. Since his arrest, rights groups such as Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have been condemning President Robert Mugabe for, quote, persecuting, unquote, the clergymen. Dewa Mavinga, Southern Africa director at Human Rights Watch, commented Wednesday on the release of Mawarire.
We welcome this development and urge the courts to be respectful of Pastor Mawarire and all other citizens' rights in terms of the rights to peaceful protest and the rights to due process of law. We hope that going forward, Zimbabwe would be respectful of these fundamental rights as enshrined in the Constitution of Zimbabwe and in a number of international conventions that Zimbabwe has ratified and is party to.
Despite coming up with a Bill of Rights in 2013, which many rights groups cheered, Zimbabweans continue to be arrested for exercising them. Rights groups fear the situation might get worse with the elections June next year. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Angola's parliament passed a bill on Thursday granting longtime president José Eduardo dos Santos and his vice president pension, but without the controversial emeritus clause giving the president absolute immunity from prosecution for any economic and political crimes he may have committed. President dos Santos, in power for 38 years, has decided not to seek another term in the August 2017 election. The bill promises to pay the president a pension that is almost 90% of his current monthly salary of about $6,200. Veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpaiva says the exclusion of the controversial emeritus clause was a victory for the opposition UNITA party and civil society groups.
First of all, the word emeritus was very tired. And also, the president dos Santos will not have a special forum. It means if there is a legal problem in the future, the formal proposal said he will must have a special forum. This was also annulled. So by 156 votes from the ruling party, MPLA, and also from CASA, CAA, which is from opposition, the law was approved. Anyway, we must take note that UNITA, the main opposition parties, votes against with 20 votes. UNITA said that despite the war satisfied with the retirement of the world emeritus and the annulation of the special legal forum for President dos Santos, they disagree because they, long time ago, are making a proposal for a law which recognizes what they call national founders, which means the late President Agostinho Neto and the late Olde Roberto and the late Jonas Savimbi. So UNITA votes against, said that the country must have also allowed that it recognizes these founder of the nations and their families to have a legal recognition by the parliament.
You're saying that even though the bill passed, but UNITA was happy because the word emeritus was taken out. Can you explain to our listeners the importance of the term emeritus?
Yes, it was important because a lot of people, not only from the opposition parties, but also civil society, criticizes this word emeritus. Even the widow of the former president, Agostinho Neto, also make a strong criticism, asking if dos Santos remain with the status of emeritus, what kind of status we must give to our first president, the late Agostinho Neto? So there was too much criticism from the society. And almost all opposition parties were satisfied with this version. But from UNITA side, they vote against with 20 votes, saying that apart from that, the country needs a law which recognizes a legal status from the late first president of Angola, Agostinho Neto, and the late UNITA leader, Jonas Savimbi, and also the late Olde Roberto, which were the leaders of the three most important National Liberation Movement.
But the bill still passes on the fact that the president will get immunity and he still gets almost his salary for retirement.
According to the present bill, the president will give the same immunity of all members of the parliament. He will not have the so-called special forum in case they have any legal problem in the future. So this, for the opposition, this is also a victory, because one of the questions they've been asking for change.
Mario, I wanted to ask you about the case of this journalist, Rafael Marquez de Moraes. We understand that he was charged. What is this case about?
He was charged the 20th of June. He was charged again, I might say, because he was also charged last December 2016. But this time, he was charged of alleged crimes against the state security and for defamations of the Attorney General and the President of the Republic, José Eduardo dos Santos. But according to the last informations, until now, there is no an official date for the trial.
In the meantime, the elections are coming up in August. How do you think the preparations are going?
For the common citizens, I think it's some kind of disillusion on politics, but most of people are saying that we go to vote, but nothing changes. It's always the same. And there are some kind of differences between the ruling party and the opposition, especially in the way the electoral national commissions have leading the process. There was a lot of mistrust from the opposition parties, accusing the ruling party of a lack of transparency.
Mario Alpava is a veteran Angolan journalist. He was speaking with me from the Angolan capital, Luanda. This year's World Food Prize, $250,000, was awarded to African Development Bank President Akinwumi Adesina. The former Nigerian Minister of Agriculture spoke to viewers Mariama Diallo from the bank's headquarters in Abidjan on the immense challenges, he says, are facing the African continent.
Akinwumi Adesina is being recognized for improving the lives of millions of small farmers across the African continent, especially in Nigeria, where he was once the agriculture minister.
Reforms he implemented increased food production by 21 million metric tons and led to and attracted $5.6 billion in private sector investments that earned him the reputation as the farmer's minister.
Now president of the African Development Bank, Adesina says he's honored that decades' work is being recognized, but noted to VOA, via Skype, that Africa's challenges are immense.
The big issue is how are we going to make sure that 250 million people that still do not have food in Africa get access to food. The other one is we've still got 58 million African children that are stunted today. And obviously, stunted children today, they are going to lead to stunted economies tomorrow.
He advocates for investing the money Africa spends on importing food into producing food.
Our task ahead is to make sure that Africa fully feeds itself, that Africa conserves that $35 billion, and Africa transforms its rural economies and create new hope and prosperity for a lot of the young people.
For that to happen, agriculture has to be attractive to young people by making it a business, not just a way of life. He says he's worked hard to make agriculture cool for youngsters.
We launched an almost $800 million initiative last year that is called Enabled Youth, which is to develop a new generation of young commercial farmers in both production, in logistics, in processing, in marketing, and all of that, all across the value chain.
He's the sixth African to win what some consider the Nobel Prize for Food and Agriculture. He will accept the prize in October in Iowa, a Midwestern U.S. state where farming is the mainstay of the economy. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
And that's it for this Thursday, June 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post-editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Carl Sterling, I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing you in Africa a very, very good day.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news, Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.